Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Do you want to get your message heard? With low advertising rates and great sponsorship opportunities, Sheffield Live can help you reach thousands of local people. Get your campaign on Sheffield Live. To find out more about advertising on Sheffield Live, write to advertising@sheffieldlive.org or call 0114 281 4082.
Hello, good evening. Here we are again on Sheffield Live, Deserted Island Disc. It's the show where we brought to have people born in the island of Ireland coming over to Sheffield, and we talk about their journey. But we've run out of Irish people, so we ran out of Irish people some time ago, so now we're just doing interesting people that live in Sheffield, and I've definitely got an interesting person tonight. It's Kit Bailey. Hello, Kit.
Hello, Ben. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much, yes. So, people didn't listen. Last week, we didn't have a show because there was some kind of football match on. But the week before, I, live on air, proposed to my partner, Tracy. And she said yes, which was quite lucky, wasn't it?
It was fantastic. It was a fantastic listen. This week's not going to be as interesting.
Well, no, it won't be.
Nothing can top that. It was fantastic.
Yeah. But no, I mean, we probably first met through Tracy there and thereabouts. I'm going to say about 15 years ago is probably when I first saw you.
Blimey, that's a long time. That's longer than I thought, yeah.
It's probably around time flies. I asked you to be a guest on a show like a long time ago because you've just got this such interesting life. Just to for the audience to know a little bit about Kit, in her own right, she's done had an amazing career in putting on events and producing. So she was, but I've only just found these things out. So I've known you 15 years, and you're very kind of good at hiding your light under a bushel. I think it is. So you don't shout about the work you've done, but you've just told me that you like produced the folk show on Radio 2, you've been involved in amazing folks, Cambridge Festival, all sorts of things for television, and we'll discover that all through time.
Yeah.
But then by association, I suppose, it's like your dad was like one of the most famous folk singers in the UK, so it's Roy Bailey, so we'll get to talk about him. And then your partner, Martin Simpson.
Yeah.
So he's another amazing folk singer, so... It's going to be an interesting hour. We shouldn't run out of things to say, should we?
No, I don't think so. No, it'd be good. I'm looking forward to it.
Good. Well, let's talk about you. So we try and... what we do, we talk for an hour and you've picked six songs, which I know is very difficult for you because music is your life.
We've narrowed it down to six. Hard.
Yeah.
But it was fun. I mean, I tend to... I don't know. I think everybody does that, but it's probably just me. I do my Desert Island Discs in my head a lot and it always changes. There's always certain things that stay on it, but interestingly, none of them are on this.
Yes, okay.
I don't quite know why.
It's always happened. So it's funny, yeah. So if you asked you to come on like next month, it'd be a different list.
It's completely different, yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's go over these what we've got. We'll get them to them in a minute. But let's start with you. Let's start at the beginning. So do you want to talk about like your kind of early life? You were kind of, go on, do you want to say about where you were born?
Okay.
Is that still?
Yeah, no, it's not a top secret. I don't tell many people, but I was actually born in Essex, in Epping.
Right.
I was born in the Forest, I think. There's a hospital called St Margaret's, and I was born in there.
Yeah.
And we moved from Epping to Bradford when I was 6 months old, so I don't consider myself an Essex girl.
Yeah.
And then we moved here to Sheffield when I was about four or five.
So you're more Yorkshire than Essex.
I'm more Yorkshire than Essex, definitely. But my dad had a job. My dad got a job at Bradford Poly, I think, then, as an academic, because he was a sociologist.
Yeah.
And then he got a job in Sheffield, so we moved here. So he was at the Poly for many years until he retired.
So your dad, I mean, I'm aware of your dad, and many people will be in the folk scene would be particularly aware of your dad as being, like, you know, yeah, one of the, would you say folk royalty? Is that
well, I think he is, yeah. No, I mean, in our little folk pond, he was a big fish,
yeah.
Definitely.
So that surprised me that he actually had a day job, really. But he was, so when was he singing like all his life from when he was like a teenager in his 20s?
And, yeah. I mean, apparently, so like the family stories are he just had this, well, it's not even a story, it was true, but he was this blessed with this amazing voice. And you know, when he lived in London, he was born in Bow, so he was a proper Cockney, and they grew up in Southend, I think. And he used to sit in the outside toilet singing. I don't think the toilet had a lock on it, so he just, you know, sit and sing.
Yeah, it's about letting know there's someone in.
Yeah, let him know somebody in, exactly. And he just, he just loved singing, and he was always a singer. But he kind of grew up in poverty, really, for many years of his life. And he started his sort of professional life as a cash register salesman.
Okay.
And he won Best Salesman, I think, of the year one year. When we were clearing out my mum's house recently, I found a Wedgwood tea set that he'd won for being cash register salesman. Well, but he always sang. Yeah, he always sang. And
But that surprised me as well, because, I mean, the other thing that I associate with your dad is being very political. Mm. But where did your dad's politics start then, or come from?
I'm not really sure. I mean, probably from where he grew up. He saw what life was like for people who didn't have much money. I mean, he was the son of a single mother. Right. And then she married, when he was about 7, a guy who was known to the police as Manchester Ted. So he was I mean, that's a whole program I could tell you about. Okay. That. But he was sort of part of that criminal life in London before the craze came in and it got really violent. So it was, he was a gentleman con man, really, his dad. But, I can tell you all about it if you want, but it'll take all
the
time.
No, let's just focus on you.
Okay. So I think his politics came from his background and growing up, and I think he enjoyed school. I think he did okay at school, but his circumstances were such that he had to leave and help earn money for the family. But then he was one of the post-war children who, well, he was born before the war, but he benefited from the welfare state and from education being available to more people. And he went to university and got involved in the politics of the 60s and just went from there, really. He was also gay. He realised he was gay.
Right.
And at a time when that was illegal, So he was very aware of people's situations that were slightly outside of the norm of society, and I think that shaped a lot of his politics.
Wow, right. I'm learning so much stuff already. So I'm saying. And what was about your mum then? So your mum's still alive and living in Sheffield still?
Yeah, she lives in Sheffield. I've just moved her into a bungalow. So my mum grew up in Tottenham. Her family was all Irish. There's an Irish link. So she was related to everybody in the two streets in Tottenham, you know, next to each other. They all knew each other. She just wanted to read books. All she ever wanted was books. And she stayed on at school, much to her mum's disgust, actually, because her mum wanted to leave education and get a job and help support the family. But she insisted on staying on after 11 plus. And she managed to get to university in Hull.
Right.
And she became a teacher. So they both kind of... And Roy became a teacher as well, but more in the poly sort of time situation. Yeah. My mum was a primary school teacher. But they met around the folk clubs and around the University of Southampton, where my mum had a boyfriend who was in a skiffle band with her boyfriend, Tony.
Okay.
And my dad was a friend of Tony's, and he introduced my mum to this nice gay guy that he knew.
Okay.
And, you know, I said that at my dad's funeral. I could see everybody's faces going, what?
Yeah. Well, I'm a bit like that.
They just got on, and my mum and dad, and they sang together, and they sat. Mum is a natural harmony singer. And they sang beautifully together. And they also got on really well with dancing. They were big rock and roll dancers.
Yeah.
And like I say, you know, homosexuality was illegal then. And I think Roy offered my mum a different life to the one that she was sort of looking at. You know, she was almost engaged to a very, as she talks about him now, kind of a very conservative young man who she wasn't really that interested in. And my dad made her laugh, and he sang, and they had music in common. It was the 60s, everything was happening, and they both wanted a slice of that. So they got together.
And it worked for them, yeah?
It really worked for them, yeah. They stayed together all their lives, you know.
Yeah,
they had a really
and they had
good
you and your brother, so they had two kids as well.
Yeah.
Does that lead us into your first song choice a little bit?
Yes, it does a little bit, yes.
Go on, do you want to explain what it is and why you picked it?
So when we were living in Bradford, my mum was teaching and my dad was teaching, and he was singing at weekends and stuff. So there was just me being a baby, and my dad's mum, my nanny, moved up to Bradford to live with us because her husband, Manchester Ted, passed away, sadly, when I was very, very small. And she came to live with us, and she looked after me. And her song that she always sang to herself and that she had on a little music box was Danny Boy.
Yeah.
And this version is just my favourite version of it. It wasn't what she knew, obviously, because Sinead O'Connor came much later, but I love this version of it.
So you picked Sinead O'Connor doing Danny Boy. This is live on the Late Late Show, so let's try that.
Oh, Danny Boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen. The summer's gone and all the flowers are falling. 'Tis you, 'tis you must go and I must bide. But come ye
Sinead, didn't she? Hey, oh, what a voice, what a voice, what a voice.
Incredible woman. Very impressive.
She is. That's my first choice of Kit Bailey, my guest tonight on Deserted Island Disc. Thanks for that, Kate. You wanted to say a bit more about kind of your early life and your influence of your nan and family there, yeah?
Yeah, my nan, she was a hell of a woman, my nan. I mean, she was... I didn't know this until much later, but she was a very... the struggle that she had bringing up my dad on her own, I think, was real, and quite often they were sort of thrown into poverty, even when she was with Gramps, Manchester Ted, who's actually called John Edward Bailey, but everybody knew him as Jack Bailey or Manchester Ted. The police knew him as Manchester
Ted. I'm going to ask you about him another time.
Another time, yeah. That's a good story. But she, when I was little, she was my person, you know, she was my 24 hours, and she didn't know many people in Bradford, she didn't know anybody in Bradford. So
she moved up to Bradford?
Yeah, she moved to Bradford, and so I was just, she was my world, and I loved her so much, and we didn't really go out and mix with people, so I was very, it was quite insular with her. So I was really, she died when I was 16, I was really sad when she died, but she moved back to London, to Walthamstow, Leytonstone area, when we moved to Sheffield, because she just missed London, really.
Yeah.
But that was all, and I love Sinead O'Connor. She's such an incredible icon of a person.
Yeah.
And it was just nice that the two things married up.
Combine the two, yeah. Mm. Okay, let's back to your story then. So, suppose you wouldn't really remember Bradford much, would you? So, and that's not as good as Sheffield anyway. Let's talk about Sheffield. So,
I do remember bits of Bradford actually, weirdly, but yeah, Sheffield was, of course, massively me. You know, just it brought me up really, and it was a great time to be in Sheffield. I mean, particularly in my family, which for me was all about music and politics. You know, my dad was very political, and there was always music in the house. And growing up, there'd be people like, you know, Martin Carthy and John Kirkpatrick and Leon Russellson, Sandra Kerr, Frankie Armstrong. These are all titans of the folk scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Come in and stay in. Steel Eye Span came to the Bradford House, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
And they'd come and stay, and it was just amazing. I mean, the house was just full of that incredible music. So they'd rehearse with my dad because they'd be playing with my dad, or they'd just come and sit and chat and play because they were playing in Sheffield at the Grapes or at various other folk clubs.
It was the Grapes, wasn't it?
It was a great folk club there. I remember going to that.
Yeah.
And the Highcliffe Folk Club, which is now the Greystones.
Yeah, I've heard of these things.
They were really kind of well-known folk clubs on the circuit. So I'd kind of creep down when I'd have to go to bed. I'd creep down and sit on the stairs and I'd listen to what was going on all night. You know, a classic kind of kid listening. I was fascinated with it all. And growing up in that sort of time, 70s, early 80s, when I became a teenager, Sheffield was like the Socialist Republic. It was the capital of the Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire, and there was always political things going on. My dad was singing at Rock Against Racism gigs in London and in Sheffield, and I was really interested in all of that world. And so my tastes in music were very, I was very much a songs person and a words person. So, much as I adored Adamant and was in love with Sting and the Police and Blondie, Debbie Harry, I nearly picked that. I was really into bands like UB40, because then they were doing stuff like I'm a One in Ten and The Beats. I love The Beat. I love Scar and The Specials. I absolutely adored The Specials. So there were bands that were saying something, you know. There was a lot more of that when I was a kid in the charts, you know, like Bronski beating the Communists, all of that. Amazing 80s time. Tom Robinson. Yeah. I nearly picked Tom Robinson singing Glad to Be Gay because my dad used to sing that in the folk clubs before he was out, which was a very brave thing to do at that time.
In South Yorkshire.
Well, all over the country he'd sing it. So, you know, I had an inkling of what was to come later in my teenage years. But yeah, that's why my next track is The Specials, because I just love The Specials. But this isn't a... Do you want me to introduce this one now?
No, that's good. Yeah, introduce it. Yeah, so go and talk about that.
So this track that I picked is because you know, I spent a lot of my teenage years going to Greenham Common and going on marches. I was always on marches. Loved it. That sense of community and that sense of doing something and making each other feel like there was more than one person who felt like this, that you were a community and you had something to say and you could say it and actually people would listen. Yeah. And The Specials were singing songs that kind of also talked about that, like Ghost Town and Too Much Too Young, loads of things. And I wanted to pick a Specials track, but I really wanted a few more women's voices in my playlist.
Okay.
And also, I still love The Specials, and I went to see them at what I still call Top Rank, but isn't Top Rank, isn't it? It's the O2.
The
Academy.
O2, yeah. A few years ago.
And it was incredible.
Did you get to see them when you were a teenager, about the first time around Specials?
I think so. I think they came to the Poly. What was the Winnie Mandela building? I don't know what it's called now, but I came...
In Manchester, yeah.
No, in Sheffield.
Sheffield, right.
The places at the Poly that you'd go and see gigs were... in Sheffield that you'd go and see gigs were mainly the Poly later the Octagon and the Hallamshire.
So you'd still be a teenager and go to those places that put these bands on, Okay, should we play it then?
Yeah, let's play this. It's an amazing track and it's got an interesting story. We can talk about it afterwards, but it's more recent.
The Commandments of I, Sophia Khan. Thou shalt not listen to Prince Buster or any other man offering kindly advice in matters of my own conduct.
feminazi or a femoid and then see if I give a stinking shit. Pseudo-intellectuals on the internet. They tell me I'm unhappy because I'm not feminine. Failing to consider that I may be unhappy because it's 3 a.m. and I'm in the depths of YouTube watching them. Whining. Thou may catcall me on the street, but thou should take note that I'll catcall you right back to tell you that you look pretty sexy too in your joggers or your suit or your newfound look of confusion. Or use man-made ideals like PARS. Don't you realise that you're only making a fool of yourself when you ask, why don't you wear makeup? Is that what it takes to impress a bloke whose brain is made up of promises of curvy size zeros and anti-gravity tits? She deserved it because her skirt was too short. She walks home, streetlights illuminating her as a target. But she started it because she looked at him, and he finished it because he wanted to. And they'll bring out her skirt as Exhibit A before the judge. And she should have the right to say, thou shalt not tell me what to wear. Nor how to wear it. I shall not be the icing on your cake, and I shall not be the candy on your arm. Seen, and I will be heard. The commandments of I, Sophia Khan. Pseudo intellectuals.
Ten Commandments, the specials. So yeah, you was going to explain a bit about that. That's
I just love I love that song, and I was really I'm always really excited when I hear the specials because they always talk about stuff. They've got something to say, and that I loved it that they got in touch with Sophia Khan after they'd seen her on one of those iconic photos where she's there was some right wing demonstration in London. I think it was. It might have even been Birmingham. Actually.
Yeah.
And there's this fantastic photo of her like standing up to this awful guy, like shouting something
face.
At her. And they got in touch with her.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the kind of result. And I just think it's fantastic. And that gig at the O2 was one of the best gigs I've ever been to. Oh. I was right down the front. I think you were there. There was definitely a group of our posse friends there.
I wasn't there. I would have remembered that. No, I have seen the specials, but not that gig. I can imagine you, because you were dancing away there. You was dancing away just in the studio, weren't you? So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So back to your life. Let's try and get back through your life as far as we can. Anyway, okay. Kate, we're nearly halfway through the show. We're not feel like we've got far, but that's fine. That's the nature of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So you what part of Sheffield did you grow up and what schools? And
so I grew up in Nether Green. I grew up in leafy S11. It wasn't quite so sort of middle class then when I was growing up there, but it's very S11 as I call it now. But I grew up on Nether Green Road and I went to Nether Green School.
Yeah.
And then I went to King Edward's and I loved it. I was good at school. I liked school. I liked learning and I had the aptitude for academia, definitely.
Yeah.
I wasn't a very sociable kid. I mean, I was quite happy at school. I liked other kids, but I didn't have that many friends. that were particular friends until I was a bit older. I think that's because I'd been so insular with my nan. I hadn't really had that much socialisation, as it were.
And I suppose you'd be, I'm just guessing, quite different to other kids in terms of like your house and what was going on there.
Yeah, definitely.
It was
like
not the usual stuff, was it?
Yeah, no, it was very, very different. And I remember saying to my mum once that I couldn't work out why I felt so different and why I didn't get on with a lot of the girls were just very different from me. And she sort of said, well, it's partly because you're going to quite a middle class school, but you're being brought up by very working class, political, weird, hippie parents, you know, and it's a very different environment. And I found my path and I found my tribe as I went through school. But yeah, it was a very different background.
But you wouldn't say it was difficult, because your first thing was you enjoyed school and you enjoyed
it. I enjoyed
it
school,
still,
I mean, I was a reader. I just read all the time. I didn't really go out and play that much. Well, I did a bit on my bike, but I was mainly a reader. I just read books. I loved it. And so I think that helped a lot with school. I was no good at maths, chemistry and physics, but I was great at English and history and all of those sorts of things.
So what did you do next then? So after school?
After school, I was determined not to go to university because I'd had enough of academia. So I had took a year off, argued with my dad, who wanted me to go. And I agreed to go to Manchester. I got a place.
Your dad was a lecturer.
Education had brought him and mum out of where they'd been and got them to where they were. And they thought it was really important that I carried on with my education. And plus, because I could do it.
Yeah.
I argued with them. And
what did you do in your year off?
I went to Nottingham with some friends who were at the poly there and with the intention of volunteering.
Is this where you aim to go to Greenham and...
Yeah, I wanted. I did my interview at Manchester because I did social anthropology at Manchester, and they asked me what I was going to do with my year off because I wanted to defer it. Yeah. I said, "Well, I want to go and live at Greenham," thinking they think this was really rebellious. And he said, and the person who interviewed me went, "Oh, that's really good. You could do your dissertation on that." And I was really sort of taken aback by it. Looking back on it, I should have done all of those things. Instead, I went to Nottingham and took speed and got stoned.
Okay.
For 6 months, and then I came back to Sheffield and did much the same for 6 months, and then I went to Manchester.
And what happened? Well, Manchester's renowned for not having those kind of things.
No,
obviously,
it's nothing so, like yeah, that. Yeah, very yeah, clean yeah, living yeah, in Manchester.
Yeah.
No, I moved to Manchester. Well, when I left school, actually, my dad paid for me to go out to Vancouver, where he was. He used to go to and sing at the Vancouver Folk Festival, and it's completely different to here. It's folk music festivals are more like Glastonbury, really, over there. And it was such an eye-opening place. And I went over for a few weeks before he came over.
So what age was this, roughly?
It was 18 when I left school, when I did my A-levels.
Okay, so
but it was a
still
seminal
in your year
point,
off kind of thing?
Just before my year off started, or when my year off started.
So that's summer, yeah.
And that's when, so before I left, my dad came up to my bedroom. It was in the attic at Nether Green Road. And he was looking really agitated. And that's when he came out to me as a gay man.
Wow.
Because his life over there in Canada, he was basically out as a gay man.
Yes.
So, and he got really upset. And I got really upset because I wasn't upset that he was gay. I thought he was, because I knew that, because he'd always had friends, you know, who were part of our life growing up. And I thought he was telling me he was leaving the family, that he finally decided he was going to leave the family. And my mum came up, walked into the room, saw us both in tears and said, and just took one look at us and said, I knew you'd mess it up. And then I knew it was all right. And so going to Vancouver was really an incredible thing. It really changed my life. Yeah, it was just me on my own to start with. Stayed with some friends of his, worked at the festival, hung out with some incredible political women, mostly gay women, and absolutely convinced then that, right, well, I'm a gay woman as well, that's what I'm doing. So when I went to Manchester, I went as a lesbian woman. Got involved in the politics there, part of the I became Lesbian Liberation Secretary, which isn't as much fun as it sounds.
Okay.
Manchester was quite a radical university.
So this is like 80s, is it?
Mid-80s.
Mid-80s, 85, 86,
I think.
Yeah.
And from that, I mean, I was doing social anthropology, but I just got involved in politics and the Students' Union, and I became, got voted in to be women's officer sabbatical for a sabbatical year. So after my second year of my course, I was paid by the Students' Union to be the women's officer at this really radical Students' Union.
So while you're still studying?
Because I took a year out from studying. And then I went back in to do my third and final year. That year was amazing, and that's how I ended up kind of, I mean, it was just before the start of all the Manchester stuff. And that year when I was women's officer, I met the events manager there, a guy called Rob Ballantyne, who was just a brilliant, he's one of my best friends still.
Yeah.
And I was having to, as part of the women's officer role, was putting on events for women. Lots of them were sort of Reclaim the Night marches, but there were also socials to raise money for the creche or whatever we were doing.
Yeah.
And that's how I got into sort of events in the first place.
Yeah. So were you like booking bands and stuff or involved in that?
Yeah, on a small scale, but in the MDH at Manchester University, we'd put on stuff and organised marches into town. It's interesting, actually, because when we did one of the Reclaim the Night marches, I had to go onto the radio and talk. And some of my friends at the end came up to me and said, "You sounded like such a Manc." Because I was talking to a Mancunian. I'm wondering whether that's happening to me now, talking to you. It'd be interesting
we'll
to
get
hear
feedback
it back.
Later on. Yeah. I don't think so. I don't sound like a Manc anymore.
Oh, no,
that's all gone, unfortunately. But, talking about that time in Manchester, so you stayed on in Manchester after you finished your degree and still involved in uni stuff and putting on events and stuff, was it?
I stayed in Manchester and I moved into a flat with Rob, who was a really good friend by that point, and another guy called Paul Smith, who's still a really good friend, and sort of obviously just got involved because Rob and Paul would be promoting events, and I ran a club for them called 1992. I think that's because something big happened in 1992. Did the European Union happen then or something? I can't remember.
I don't know.
But it wasn't in 1992. It was just called that. There was lots of publicity about that year. And we ran it at the Poly, and we ran it with a DJ called Dave Booth, who was a brilliant Manchester DJ. He was just one of the best. And it was that point where all the Hacienda stuff was happening. He'd quite often DJ at the Hacienda. And, you know, I was working in 5th Avenue and 42nd Street in Manchester.
So I was Jeff probably there at that time,
I probably took your coat on the door or served you a drink behind the bar.
Yes.
But I loved it. It was such a brilliant time to be in Manchester. It's just, you can't explain it to people who weren't there. Yeah. It was fantastic.
But that being around that environment of the clubs and stuff, I suppose lots of people would do that and work behind a bar and take coats and stuff, but then, you know, not have a career in it. I'll take it any further than that. What changed for you?
Well, it's partly Rob employing me to run one of his nights at the university, and we took it to London to the Town and Country Club once, and, you know, it was a touring night with Dave being the DJ and whatever. But then also I got a job working, taking the census, weirdly, after I finished my degree. And the woman who was my kind of head person on that job knew that they were looking for somebody at the Museum of Science and Industry to run the Castlefield Carnival. And she looked at what I'd put in my CV to get that census-taking job. And she said, "Oh, you might be interested in this." So my first event thing on my own was putting together the Castlefield Carnival,
which
was amazing.
Yeah. So what was that involved in? Is that a big
It was a family event. It was in the Castlefield Bowl. Yeah, so we had, like, gallopers. We had a big carousel thing and we had stalls. And it was working with the waterways people, because the canal's all in there, so there was music, there were stalls, there were family things to do, fairground type things, and it was brilliant. I loved it.
Good. Well, one of your choices, I think we're going to skip it. Even if it was short, we wouldn't have time for it because we're over halfway through. So, you can say what you would have picked, and listeners can just Google it.
Okay.
They probably know it, don't they?
They probably know it. Well, it's Fool's Gold by the Stone Roses, and although I was more of a Happy Mondays girl, to be honest. I love Happy Mondays, but I love the Stone Roses as well. But that particular track, Dave Booth used to do these amazing mixes of that into something bonkers like Rebel MC. Street Tough by the Rebel MC, which I loved and is very evocative of Manchester for me, those clever mixes. And it reminds me of people like Rob and Paul Smith and Jeff, who I eventually went out with for a long time, my friend Rich, Carol, all those people in Manchester.
So we're not playing that one, but are we ready for your next one or not?
There's a bit of an explanation. Is that the Spanish one?
The Spanish one, yeah.
Yeah, so when I was looking for work in Manchester, and I ended up not working in Manchester, I ended up moving over to East Yorkshire to work for an agency called Adastra. It was run by a woman called Chris Wade, and she was working for lots of European bands at the time. And there was this one band we were working for called La Muscaña from central Spain. And one of the members of La Muscaña became one of the loves of my life at the time. And this is a track that they played, and it's absolutely beautiful.
Okay, let's try it.
¶¶ Well, my name is Martin Simpson, and you're listening to Sheffield Live on 93.2 FM and sheffieldlive.org.
Yes, that's our Martin there. Yeah, we'll speak about him in a bit, eh?
Yeah, he's brilliant.
he's a friend of Sheffield Live, so Martin he Simpson's Kit's husband. So mm-hmm. You've been married 21 years, you're saying?
21 years and just about a month. Yeah.
Well, he's not in your life yet, have you, of where we're going. So we were listening to Deserted Island Dis, where we talked to guests about their life, and they pick some music that punctuates their life and talks us through how they've got where we are today. So Kit's been great. We've got 20 minutes left, Kit, to get through some more songs and the rest of your life. So... do you want to talk a little bit about that track, though?
It's just a beautiful track, and my favourite instruments are weirdly bagpipes and hurdy-gurdies. And that's the guy playing the bagpipes there is a guy called Kike Almendros, who is still alive, but he had an awful aneurysm, an awful stroke, so he can't play anymore. But he was an amazing musician and an amazing artist as well. excuse me, and that sort of period of my life was really formative for me, working for Chris Wade at Ad Astra. And then I left Ad Astra to set up my own folk music agency with the help of a guy called, well, funded by a guy called John Eales down in Gloucester.
Right.
And that was Brass Tacks Music Agency. And I was working not with very many European bands, but with my dad and with people like Martin Carthy and Dave Swarbrick. And Ian Carr and Karen Tweed, Chris Wood and Andy Cutting, Eliza Carthy and Nancy Kerr, just lots of amazing names.
So you were their agent?
I was their agent, yeah, for quite a few years, for about 3 years down in Gloucester. And then I wasn't really enjoying living in Gloucester. I didn't really make many friends apart from one really good friend called Clive, who's still a great friend. So I moved back to Sheffield, and John very kindly let me bring the agency with me because he didn't want to carry it on. So I became self-employed, which was a big jump at that time, but then I didn't want to let go of that. It was great being
so what was that involved in being the agent then? So it was like getting gigs and...
Yeah, getting gigs, whatever. Booking the tours, phoning up venues, trying to... I mean, with lots of the artists, it was quite easy in many ways because they were already well-known.
Yeah.
But it was at a time when a lot of the folk clubs were closing down, so you were trying to open new avenues with art centres and stuff, and talking to art centres about how folk music's actually quite cheap to put on. It doesn't need a big PA or anything.
Lighting.
And it's got... Or lighting, yeah. And it's got a dedicated audience, you know. Yeah. It's a really... strong following, always has been, but
because that would be my impression is that the probably in the 90s was or like it was 90s early 2000s when you do it was probably like the lowest point of folk music really in terms of like obviously in the 60s and 70s to some extent and then it's kind of feels like it's very vibrant now.
It is, and I think people like Chris Wade, who I used to work for, and Steve Heap, who was involved with he ran Mrs. Casey Music, who put on some of the biggest festivals in the country, and John Leonard, who I ended up working for, who used to be at Radio Sheffield and then was at Radio 1 for a long time, but then he set his own radio production company up and took over the folk show.
Yeah.
They sort of started to professionalise it a bit, which was a little bit difficult. A lot of the folk clubs didn't like that because it was very friendly sort of scene. Yeah. But there was room for both, I think.
Yeah. That's a good point. I suppose the folk show might have been a catalyst for a lot of stuff. It was now.
Yeah, particularly the folk awards. I mean, when John... and Bob Harris pitched that idea to Radio 2. It was amazing that they took it up. It was fantastic. Radio 2's commitment to specialist music was massive then.
Yeah.
It's still there. But at that time, there was more money around and they started the Folk Awards and it was a massively prestigious thing. So although it didn't necessarily reflect the smaller folk scene and some of the lesser-known artists, it definitely reflected the more mainstream sort of idea of folk music and propelled people like Kate Rusby and, you know, Martin Simpson as well and lots of other people into a world, again, into sort of a more widespread world. It became more mainstream.
Yeah,
and
it definitely
had a different...
Yeah, that spotlight on it. I think because it's like I'd class myself as a casual folky, I think. So you'd kind of pay attention to stuff. But when you'd see the Folk Awards and see so many people there and amazing music in that one space, it kind of made you get into it and maybe you kind of look at those artists more, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's Radio 2 specialist music programmes are meant to be entry-level programmes. So, you know, like I've never liked jazz particularly, but I'd listened to Humphrey Littleton doing the jazz show and loved it. But a hardcore jazzer, like I was probably a hardcore folky, would listen to it and go, oh, that's not real jazz. That's not the real stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And criticise it as a jazz programme. But it's not meant to be, like the folk programme wasn't meant to be stuff that it was very special.
It's got to be accessible.
And I think it really really brought folk music into the fore, and it became, certain artists became huge, like Kate became huge. She's great and deserves it. And the Unthanks, and it sort of started to get heard by more people, and you hear those people and you look at other things as well. That was the main hope.
And that, so you were involved in some of those shows as well. So just get back to you, I suppose, kind of that progression.
So I got a bit bored of being an agent. I didn't like, I realised that I liked events. I liked seeing things happen. And being an agent's quite difficult. You're quite responsible for everything. And I got in touch with John once when he was doing like Bob Dylan's 50th birthday or something. It was years ago. And said, oh, I know a lot about Bob Dylan, because all my tracks could have been Bob Dylan or Joni Mitchell, but I avoided it. And said, I'd really like to work with you. And he sort of took me on and trained me up to be the folk. He wanted to find someone who could produce the folk show with Mike Harding, as it was then. And I was doing lots of other bits and pieces. I wasn't just doing agency stuff, because I was trying to diversify. And actually looking outside at that building, which is now the Sheffield Poly building, it was the National Centre for Popular Music.
That's right, yeah. That's and where
went,
we are. Opposite.
I went for an interview there when it was still the National Centre and didn't get the job. I wasn't right for it. But they put me forward to Radio 2 to work on their Live in Sheffield, Radio 2 in Sheffield week.
Okay.
So I did that, putting together a fringe of lots of different musics around what they were doing. And I did that in Nottingham as well. So I sort of started to work for Radio 2 that way. And then I started working for John, who ran an independent production company doing the folk show.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how I got to the Folk Awards. And that's how I met Martin, actually.
Let's talk about him, eh? We've not got there yet. So we've got 15 minutes.
Okay.
Go on.
Well, the most important person in my life, him and my daughter. I met Martin when I was working for Radio 2 rather than for John Leonard, and he'd come over from America where he was living to do a live Radio 2 in Nottingham then. And my dad introduced me to him, because my dad had known him since he was very young. He says he remembers it, but I don't think he remembers it. And then a few years later, he'd moved back to England.
Because you were like a groupie.
I wasn't really a groupie, no. No, interestingly, I was more of a kind of a Martin Carthy guitar fan.
Right.
But then I saw this guy doing... My brother used to take me to Martin Simpson's gigs, because he thinks Martin's amazing. And I'd just sit there and go, this guy is incredible. And he just created this atmosphere that was unlike anybody else. And it was beautiful. And I used to bump into him at the Folk Awards. He was always nominated because he was amazing. So he'd often come and play, or he'd be there. And then I'd see him at different festivals around the country where I was often stage managing or artist liaison stuff. And he one day at Beverley Folk Festival professed love for me at that time. And I had no idea. Aww. And it's sort of the rest is history. And we got together. Eventually we had Molly, our daughter Molly, who's just this incredible human being.
Yeah, she's 21 now.
Just got back from South Africa today.
She's been
having an incredible
time. Well done,
time.
You. You've been going back to Manchester Airport, haven't you?
I did. Well, I went yesterday, because they were supposed to come yesterday, but the flight got cancelled, so I came back today. Picked them up, her and her friends. And she's amazing. And this next track is something that she wants. You know, when she was going through her teenage years, she faced a lot of challenges. She had lots of trouble with bullying at school and stuff, and you know, as a parent you want to make everything all right, but you also want them to find out how to navigate it themselves. So there's a period where we were going through a really difficult time, you know, clashing a bit. I was trying to do things she wasn't really wanting me to do, and then one day she said to me, Mum, which calls me mother, this track reminds me of you. And it was amazing.
So it's Sweet Creature, Harry Styles.
Yep.
Talk about where it's going wrong, but we're still young. don't know where we're going, but we know we belong. No, we started two hearts in one home. It's hard when we argue, we're both stubborn, I know. But oh, sweet creature, sweet creature, wherever I go, you bring me home. Sweet creature, sweet creature, and I run out of road. You bring me home. Running through the garden, oh, when nothing bothered us. But we're still young. I always think about you and how we don't speak enough. No, we started two hearts in one home. No, it's hard we argue, we're both stubborn, I know. But oh, sweet creature, sweet creature, wherever I go, you bring me home. Sweet creature, sweet creature, when I run out of road, you bring me home. Just two hearts in one home. It gets harder when we argue, we're both stubborn, I know. But oh, sweet creature, sweet creature, wherever I go, you'll bring me home. Sweet creature, sweet creature, when I run out of road, you'll bring me home. You'll bring me home.
Great, Harry Styles.
It's good that you were talking to me when that was on, because it always makes me cry.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's good. I mean, it's just when you know, we were having a difficult time, and she's just such an incredible person, and to have that emotional intelligence at that age, it was sort of mid-teens, to kind of understand that even though we were having this difficult time, we were so important to each other and we loved each other so much. I mean, she's just amazing, and I love that song. And I explained to Martin why I'd chosen it, and then I put it on because he didn't know it yesterday when we were having our tea. We both just ended up in tears and our fish and chips.
I'm going to have to listen to it again now.
It's a lovely song.
No, it's because I was going to say, I wouldn't expect you to have picked Harry Styles, knowing you a little bit, but no, it all makes sense now. We are very, very quickly running out of time, so I'm just going to get you straight into the next song, because there's a bit of a story behind that, wasn't there? So just want to try and tell us a bit about your final song choice.
Well, my final song choice, to start with, it's my dad and my husband performing together, which was always really important. You know, when Martin and I got married, my dad did a little speech at our very small wedding and said, I don't feel like I've not so much lost as daughter as gained an accompanist. Because Martin played for my dad for many years. And actually, I'll come back to that. But, you know, My dad never wrote songs. He always just found songs, or people would send him songs, because he just said, why should I try writing songs when there are so many amazing songwriters out there? But he interpreted songs so brilliantly. He was an incredible singer of songs.
Yeah.
And, you know, the politics of this song sort of sums up everything that he was about. And it's written by a guy called Rob Johnson, who was one of those amazing songwriters. And my dad always, you know, he sang songs about people's lives and the challenges that people had, and his academic work was about that as well. And he used to do this show with Tony Benn called The Writing on the Wall.
Yes.
They met at the Atoll Poddle Martyrs Convention and just got on incredibly well. And then Tony Benn was an amazing human being. What an incredible man.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad was amazing.
Did you meet him a lot then, Tony Benn?
Yeah. Well, I used to agent for the show for a while as well. Okay, so every now and again, I'd pick up the phone and, kid, it's Tony Benn. And I was like, oh, my God. You know, I never really got over the starstruckness of that with him.
Yeah.
But it was a great show, and it was a show about the history of dissent in words and music. So Tony would talk about a period of history, and my dad would sing a song that would go with it.
I saw that show at Shambhala Festival.
Oh, did you?
Yes,
okay.
It was fantastic. Yeah. In a tent there, God, it was all spellbound. Yeah.
It was an amazing show. I mean, they did it at Cambridge Folk Festival in the early 2000s, and, you know, that festival is 10,000 capacity, and I think at least 9,000 people went to see it, and they won a folk award for the best live act that year.
Yeah,
and amazing. It was a great, great show. Yeah. I miss it so much. Like, I miss my dad's concert so much. But, yeah, this song is... When my dad was in the hospice in his last few days, Martin would go in and take his guitar in and play for him. And he was playing this song, which he used to play with my dad. And my dad sat up and at one point just sang the last verse of this, which is just so moving. So, yeah, it's really important, this song.
Let's play that.
There's always the money for missiles and tanks. There's always the money for generals and banks. There's always the money for new ways to kill. But a limited budget for you if you're ill. Yes, there's always enough for a war. But there's never enough for the poor. The money for tunnels and roads, for opera and ballet, but what about homes, for MPs' expenses and fat subsidies? But there's never the money for nurseries, and the well-off, they always take more. So there's never enough for the poor. Money for tests they can pass, or fail you for not being white, middle class. There's always the goodies for those with most greed, but never enough for those in most need. There's a pay rise if you're on the board, but there's never enough for the poor. Consider how little of life that we know. We bring nothing, take nothing, pass through and go. We're all of us poor when it comes to the night. In need of the darkness, in need of the light. if we'd learn to want less and love more. There'd be enough for the poor if we learn to want less and love more. There'd be enough for the poor, 'cause there's more than enough for us all.
Amazing. That's the final choice of my guest, Kip Bailey. Wow, it was wonderful. I'm nearly in tears now, as you can say. And it's the last thing that your dad sang.
Yeah, that last verse was the last thing he ever sang, which is just sort of sums him up, really. And, you know, my whole life is mainly because of him, because of his life in music and his politics, and it really influenced me. And I'm so proud of him. And, you know, I'm still doing events now. I work with my friend Sam Hindley live at Sam's, putting on gigs in Sheffield, and I love it. It's my favourite thing, and it just harks back to my childhood all the time, and that whole time of music and folk music and people and all of that.
Have we got time to say what you're up to these days then? We've got about 40 seconds, but yeah, you want to plug that? The Sam's thing. So that, I've been to a couple of those events. They're great, aren't they? Come.
Yeah, so my friend Sam puts on a house concert in his house. He's been doing that for a long time, but he wants to, I'm sure Sam will be one day putting on gigs at the City Hall. He loves promoting folk music. Yeah. He's such a supporter. He's brilliant. And I work with him on the bigger gigs just because I've got experience of that. But I'm sure he'll outgrow me soon. But I do that, and I do other events and stuff, anything really that comes along.
Yeah, it's still in the game. Yeah, aren't they, doing it?
Yeah, I love it.
Oh, well, so thank you so much, Kit. It's been a wonderful hour. It has gone so quick.
Thank you.
But thank you. And we'll be back next week for another guest on Deserted Island Days. Thanks, everyone.